Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's morning show, we're going to be talking about one of the most harrowing chapters in recent American history, America's frantic, desperate exit from South Vietnam in the waning days of the Vietnam conflict. That occurred 40 years ago, and it is being marked by the telecast this weekend of an extraordinarily powerful documentary film, part of the PBS series American Experience, called Last Days in Vietnam. I was sent a preview copy and viewed it, and I highly encourage you to view this film. You should consult your local listings. That is a film not to be missed. Unfortunately, it was not possible because of schedules for me to do an interview with anybody involved in the creation of this marvelous documentary. But I thought I would turn to the morning show archives and replay for you today a portion of my conversation with Tom Clavin, who was one of the co-authors of a book widely regarded as the definitive account of America's exit from South Vietnam, a book called Last Men Out, published by Simon & Schuster. One of the things that I told Tom Clavin as I introduced that interview was the fact that even though we read this book knowing how the story ends, nevertheless, it reads like a thriller in which we actually turn the pages faster and faster with a sense of actual anxiety about how the story, in fact, will in fact turn out. And I asked Tom Clavin how he managed to achieve such a sense of suspense, even with a story that, at least in the broader framework, we all know very well.
Well, very early on, while we were working on this book, Bob Drury came up with the idea of, he made a comparison to Frederick Forsyth's Day of the Jackal. And as some people recall, that was a very big bestseller, and they made it into a well-done movie. And it's a novel, and it is about the person sent to assassinate Charles de Gaulle, who was you know, an assassination attempt on him when he was president of France. Now, we all knew when that book came out, we all knew, well, de Gaulle's still alive, so this couldn't have been successful. So we knew the ending. But the book was still written in that if you can get caught up in the story and in the characters, there's always that little element of doubt. It's like, well, do I really know the ending? And in the case of Last Man Out, we know the ending in the sense that, well, I think a lot of people think they knew the ending. And the reason why I say that is because for 35 years we had this image in our mind, that iconic image of a helicopter on the roof and these civilians going up this ladder and climbing into this helicopter. And for 35 years, we were told that was the last helicopter out of Saigon leaving the roof of the American embassy. And one of the things our book points out is that that's not true. That's completely false. So if people think that was the last helicopter out and that was the final event in the Vietnam War, well, they were wrong.
That we should just mention that that's a picture of an entirely different building, and it's the day building. Before this desperate evacuation.
It's like 15 hours before the final helicopter left Saigon. It's civilians, not military personnel, and it's on a different building. It's not the U.S. Embassy. So most people picking up this book are really not going to know what the ending is. Now, we have when it boils down to the very end of the book, we have 11 U.S. Marines on the roof of the American Embassy, and they're surrounded by 150,000 North Vietnamese who were flooding into the city, and there's angry South Vietnamese, and there are people charging up the staircase of the American embassy trying to burst out on the roof and kill these Marines. And, you know, I think most people really won't know the ending, you know, because the story was, as you mentioned in your introduction, undertold. A lot of people picking up this book are not going to know if some of those Marines survived, all of them survived, none of them survived. You're really not going to know until the end.
Right. And I guess, again, just to reiterate my compliment, I did know how this ended just because I have read something about it before. And yet, because it is written so beautifully, I still found myself kind of caught up in wondering all over again. And I compliment you and your co-author for achieving that. Tell us.
Thanks. I think that's because if you can make a connection to the characters, you know, we are seeing these Marines all throughout the book, and then with other characters too, and then it boils down to these 11 on the roof of the American embassy. And if you've made any kind of connection with those characters, then it really makes it a more worthwhile reading experience to wonder what's going to happen to them. And you mentioned something else in your introduction about has the story been told before or not told enough. The Fall of Saigon books that are out there and that have been published over the years, almost without exception, have been from the point of view of either journalists who were there covering the events. So it's their memoirs. Peter Arnett, for example, of CNN, wrote a very good book, particularly good book about it, and other journalists have done it too. Or they're from the point of view of world leaders, politicians, people in the intelligence community who were in some way connected to those events. Just one example is Henry Kissinger has twice basically told the story of the Fall of Saigon in two different books. But what's not really out there is the point of view of the soldiers, the ones who were there on the front lines at the very end. And that's these Marines. And they were there literally keeping the embassy open and a lot of angry people out so that this amazing helicopter evacuation could take place.
I am impressed that although this book is primarily their story, that is of these Marines in Saigon, that you do far more than just give sort of lip service or token attention to the plight of the South Vietnamese themselves.
Yes.
And I appreciate that balancing act very, very much. Tell us to whom you reached out and what that experience was like to speak with, for instance, Marines and a few Vietnamese and other officials who experienced this firsthand.
Well, the first people that we had to talk to, or at least gain their confidence, were the surviving Marines. The very first one who I had spent time with was Sergeant Juan Valdez, who was one of the main characters of the book. And when he, you know, became convinced that we were not doing this story to exploit him or the Marines or anything like that, he opened a lot of doors for us. I mean, he put us in touch with some of the other surviving Marines, and being able to say, you know, Sergeant Valdez is okay with this, you know, made an impression on other people, because he's to this day he's a revered figure in the Marine Corps and in military circles, and he's 73 or 74 now, but I'll tell you, He looks like he could put on a uniform and go to Afghanistan tomorrow. I mean, he's still a tough as nails Marine, so that helped. I think the what impressed us too is that when we were spending time with the surviving Marines, to this day, they still have a great deal of sympathy and to some extent regret that we didn't get out all South Vietnamese civilians that we had promised to get out. You know, that's sort of been forgotten in the mists of history, that there were direct parallels to what's going on in Afghanistan today, is over the years of the Vietnam War, we had made promises to civilians who had acted as interpreters and bartenders and maids and served in the local military police and all these others, to say, when we leave, we'll take you with me in case if there's any concern that your lives may be in jeopardy. And then push came to shove, and it all hit the fan, and everybody's trying to leave as fast as they could because the North Vietnamese are about to take over the city. And thanks to the what remains the largest helicopter evacuation in history, thousands of people were airlifted out of Saigon at the last minute. But there was something like 400 who, when the last helicopter left, were still in the compound saying, "Is it our turn yet?"
Right. You write at one point, they remained queued up in their squared sticks, mm-hmm. awaiting a rescue that would never arrive.
Yeah, it's a sad thing, and I remember as part when we were actually towards the end of finishing the book, there's actually an organization called the Fall of Saigon Association, and people can locate it, fallofsaigonassociation.org. They were having a 35th anniversary reunion in April of 2010, and I was privileged to be invited to attend that weekend with them down at the Marine Corps headquarters in Quantico, and hanging around talking to them there, they would continually come back to that they wanted to get every civilian out. So there was a when you have the toughest of the tough, the Marines, expressing such empathy about the Vietnamese, you get a really strong sense of how much they cared and how much it was they considered the wrong thing that the planning wasn't in place, that we didn't get everybody out. And you wonder now, I mean, obviously since 2001 we've made who knows how many promises to Afghani civilians. That, you know, if push comes to shove and we have to get out real fast, we'll take you with us. And you kind of wonder, are we going to see Saigon all over again if that happens?
We're speaking with Tom Clavin about the book Last Men Out, The True Story of America's Heroic Final Hours in Vietnam. And it's interesting, when I read that subtitle, I was really a bit taken aback because I think most analysts of history would not describe America's exit from Vietnam as anything heroic in terms of how that was carried out. But I think what your subtitle is pointing to is the heroism of those men, those Marines, who, through no fault of their own, were left to try to make some sense of a really untenable situation. And that's really what's heroic about America's final hours in Vietnam, is specifically these Americans.
Yeah, that's why we wanted to make sure that word was in the subtitle, because these last group of Marines, and I'm not confining it just to the 11 who were on the rooftop and essentially left behind, because there had been about 150 of them at the embassy compound and at the airport, the defense attaché's office. And they were the ones who were making sure that helicopters could land and lift off these thousands of people, American personnel and especially Vietnamese civilians. And they were under constant threat of being attacked. Two Marines died that were Marine security guards. And they did their job and at any moment wondering if they were going to be overwhelmed and killed. Or maybe even captured, and they'd all heard the stories from during the Vietnam War of the treatment of American prisoners by the North Vietnamese. So it was dozens of displays of heroism during those last hours. And unfortunately for them, their story was kind of obscured because they came back to an America that had moved on. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to remember that it was in January of 73 that the Paris Peace Accords were signed, which required that the United States withdraw its military personnel from South Vietnam. And here we are over 2 years later is when Saigon fell. And in the interim, during those 2 years, as far as America was concerned, the Vietnam War was already receding into history. We'd moved on to other things. We had the Watergate crisis and the first resignation of a sitting U.S. president and Gerald Ford taking over. And there was a lot of economic problems. Some people might remember the win buttons, whip inflation now, I think it was. That we had having all kinds of accounts. So So nobody was really that interested in what these guys did at the very, very, very end of the what was, you know, the Vietnam War was our final evacuation. And so it really was over three decades later that Bob Drury and I would come along and find the story that had not been told, certainly from the point of the view of the boots on the ground.
Hmm. The first part of the book is called Dominoes. And I think the reason that term is chosen is because one of the reasons these final hours were so difficult is because events in South Vietnam moved so quickly, the situation deteriorated so much more rapidly than anyone anticipated, and hence the desperation of this final evacuation. Just say a brief word, if you would, about this deterioration, why it was so precipitously fast, and how that dramatically affected then the shape and scope of the evacuation.
Well, again, you know, we can draw a parallel to what could happen in Afghanistan. The South Vietnamese government that we left in place when we withdrew our military personnel was an extremely corrupt government, a very weak government. It was really a house of cards. And when in the spring, what they called their Great Spring Offensive in the spring of 1975, when the North Vietnamese applied real pressure on the South Vietnamese forces and bureaucracy, it collapsed. It collapsed very fast. There were some South Vietnamese officers who were heroic in that they were fighting for their country and not for their government. But for the most part, the South Vietnamese military had very little support system. Their government was ineffective. We had drastically cut the budget that we sent to South Vietnam for tanks and armaments and things like that. So once one city fell, another city fell, Phnom Penh fell, you know, the other countries were all in disarray also. So it was sort of like once there was a crack in the dam, all the water came flooding through, and the last place standing basically was Saigon. And at the very end, the American ambassador, Graham Martin, still believed that he could negotiate some kind of truce, some kind of settlement that would allow the South Vietnamese government to stay in place. He was badly disillusioned, but the feeling was, hey, up until the last minute, there's still a way to salvage this. But there was no way. You know, once the enemy, which is what we call them then, started making all their gains, it was a sprint towards the capital, and there was the tide of history was against those still trying to hold out.
Describe to our listeners what kind of numbers we are talking about by the end in terms of the mass of North Vietnamese soldiers, well-trained, well-armed, encircling Saigon. And also explain this curious matter of how, at least to some extent, they held back, despite the fact that in many respects it was a sprint. In some ways, they were also compelled to allow as much evacuation as did take place.
Well, there were approximately 150,000 North Vietnamese troops with, you know, tanks and artillery. They were well-armed, well-trained soldiers, and they surrounded Saigon. There were some elements of the Viet Cong, but this was really the victory of the North Vietnamese, who saw that they were reuniting the country, not conquering another country. And When they encircled Saigon, they did hesitate, and the reason why is that they were nudging the American ambassador to get everybody out. You know, they were pretty intelligent in thinking, if we just go in and start killing indiscriminately, including American personnel, we don't know what the reaction is going to be. We don't know if President Ford will say, okay, we have to retaliate, I'm sending more troops back in, or we're going to launch the B-52s again and bomb Hanoi and our supply lines. So they did hesitate with the idea is we're giving you some time. We're not making it official. We're not putting out any radio signals about it or putting up any billboards. But the remaining, you know, there was a small contingent of American military still in Saigon. There were the diplomats and the personnel at the American embassy and other office buildings, journalists to some extent. Here's your chance. Leave now, and we can have a peaceful, orderly entrance into Saigon. And finally, but Graham Martin, again being disillusioned, refused to leave. And finally, the North Vietnamese had to up the ante a little bit by they began shelling the airport and saying, "Listen, this is the signal. We're coming in." And they started coming in, and that led to what was a very mad scramble that lasted about 20 hours to try and evacuate thousands of people.
One of the terms you use to describe it is a flying circus. Mm-hmm. That there were amazing, in a sense, traffic jams in the sky.
Yeah.
Because there were all kinds of helicopters up in the air, especially in the early going. And this is one of those complications that, I mean, the typical American knew nothing about then or now until mm-hmm. we read about that in your book.
One of the things when we were doing the research and talking to pilots Captain Jerry Berry, who later became major, really admiring how difficult the logistics of this was called Operation Frequent Wind, how difficult the logistics were because the we had waited too late really to order the evacuation initiated. Everything had to be urgent. Everything had to be done faster than safety and sense would allow. And so you did have this two-way traffic from the fleet out in the ocean, sending helicopters in, helicopters landing, picking up people, as many as they can cram into a helicopter, lifting off as fast as possible, flying back out as other helicopters are flying back in. And this went on hour after hour after hour. And even when it got dark, and at nighttime, at the American Embassy, for example, they got all kinds of vehicles and trucks, and they surrounded the helicopter landing pad. So it could be illuminated, so helicopters could keep landing on it with their headlights on, so it could have gotten into chaos. I should mention too that all the while these helicopters are coming under enemy fire. The Vietnamese are shooting at them as they're coming in and leaving the city. So it's pretty remarkable that only one helicopter was lost in the entire operation, with a couple of men aboard killed. A lot of helicopters were damaged, but just kept flying. You had heroic guys like Jerry Berry, who spent nearly 20 hours straight in the air just because he wouldn't quit while there were still people desperately trying to leave.
One of the things that, of course, is especially tragic is that there had been an attempt at some point of making this orderly, of there mm-hmm. being a sense of protocol, of people having written documentation saying that they should deserve to safely depart, and yet the pandemonium in the streets, as you described it, eventually, in fact, quickly made it impossible for some of that carefully conceived protocol, in fact, to be carried out. I mean, this indeed eventually became nothing but a mad scramble.
It was. I mean, we have several scenes in there at the American Embassy. All the gates are closed. The Marines are manning the gates and the parapet, so to speak. And outside, the embassy compound is ringed by thousands of Vietnamese who are pushing against the gates, trying to climb over the walls and desperate to get out. The expectation was that when the North Vietnamese entered the city, there would just be massacres. They would be just literally lining people up against the walls and shooting them. And so they were desperate to get out, and it was the Marines' job to not let them into the compound, because then the helicopter evacuation would come to a complete halt. That'd be total chaos. And you had South Vietnamese civilians who, as I mentioned, they may have served for years as busboys, as housekeepers, as whatever, telephone operators. But if they didn't have the proper papers, and got to the point where nobody really knew what the proper papers were anymore, you couldn't get in. You couldn't be evacuated. And so, the Marines felt absolutely awful about this, and they were in some cases making life and death decisions. At one point, Sergeant Valdez is standing on the shoulders of one of his guys, reaching over the fence and literally just lifting people up off the ground because they could show, hey, I'm an American reporter. Hey, I'm a stenographer working for, the ambassador's assistant, something like that. And literally lifting people over. And one time when they opened the gates to try and get there were a couple of women outside and trying to grab a couple of women, get them in, some of the Vietnamese started pouring in. And one of them, a Vietnamese soldier, took his bayonet and ran it through one of our characters, Sergeant Steve Schuller. And there was almost pandemonium until the Marines got the gates closed again. So it was a situation that at any moment could have gotten out of control.
And one of the things that Valdez shares in terms of what frightened him the most, this is a complication we haven't even touched on. He was frightened, you write at one point, not at the prospect of a fight of the Major's Alamo. He was prepared for that. It was the fear of not knowing whether it would be the North Vietnamese storming full force through the city until they reached the embassy, or the bitter ARVNs turning on them. That is, soldiers from South Vietnam's own army. I mean, that had to add tremendously to the sense of chaos and fear that was part of this.
Yeah, I spoke to a fellow who lives in the United States now, but he had been a soldier in the South Vietnamese Army in Saigon that day. And he talked about how desperate and frightened they were, and also a great sense of betrayal. They felt betrayed by their own government, by their own officers. They felt betrayed by the Americans who were all leaving and being left behind were the South Vietnamese soldiers. I mean, he said he attacked somebody and took his clothes, and he took his own uniform off, put the other guy's clothes on, and thought that maybe he could just pass as a resident of Saigon, a civilian. He eventually was caught, and he spent 2 years in what they called a re-education camp that he actually escaped from and made his way to the United States. So the Americans were you know, not just worried about what might happen if the North Vietnamese troops overwhelmed the city, but you had, you know, these roving bands, who know how many of them there were, of South Vietnamese soldiers with weapons, who at any moment could decide, you know what, we might die anyway, let's take some of those Americans with us, or they're just angry and not thinking straight at all and just start shooting. So they were in jeopardy from several different areas there, the Marines, and that there was no way they could turn was safe.
And of course, eventually the gates are ordered closed, and the order comes from Washington: just get the last Americans out. Mm-hmm. And eventually, we have on the roof of the embassy about a dozen U.S. Marines left. Tell our listeners how long those Marines had to wait on the roof of the embassy before a helicopter came to spirit them away.
Yeah, there were 11 guys. They were led by Major James Keene, who, along with Valdez and Sergeant Sullivan, had actually seen combat during the Vietnam War, and he had a Purple Heart to prove it. They were up on the roof of the American embassy. They had put the ambassador, finally, you know, forced him to leave, put him on a helicopter. He is on his way back to the fleet. And through an error, transmission error, when Captain Barry was heading back to the fleet with the ambassador, the message he gave was taken by the fleet to mean, I've got everybody out. And he was saying, I've got the ambassador, but they took that to mean there's no American personnel left. And so they stopped the evacuation operation. No more helicopters left the fleet for Saigon, not knowing that we had 11 guys locked and loaded on the roof of the American embassy and 150,000 North Vietnamese entering the city. And also what had happened was when they had gone up to the roof, there were 6 floors to the roof, they had barricaded every stairwell. They'd locked down the elevators, barricaded every stairwell leading up to the doorway to the roof. And what had happened was people had you know, ran into the embassy, breaking things, finding weapons, stealing things, whatever they could do, and had broken down the barricades one flight after another until they were outside pounding on the door to get out on the roof. And at any moment, these guys, you know, wondered, when is that door going to give way, and where there's only 11 of us on the roof, and how many thousands are going to come streaming out of that doorway. So they, you know, 1 hour passed by, more time passed by, there's no sign of any other helicopter, and it got to the point where these guys actually took a vote and said, when they come out on this rooftop, do we try and surrender, and maybe they'll at worst hold us hostage, or do we take as many with them as we can? And they voted. The vote was unanimous. When they come through that door, we'll take as many with them as we can. And so, you know, what happened to these 11 guys is, I guess people have to read the book.
Right. And at the end, someone says that at least they can be buoyed by the knowledge that they helped to secure one small triumph in the war's final crucible. Their country may have lost something that it might never recover, but they had persevered with dignity and courage. The book, again, is called Last Men Out, The True Story of America's Heroic Final Hours in Vietnam. This is published by Free Press, co-written by Bob Drury and my morning show guest, Tom Clavin. Tom Clavin, I thank you so much for this important book and for talking with me today on the morning show.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And again, a reminder that on the PBS American Experience series, Monday evening, actually, there will be a telecast of a brand new documentary about this dramatic chapter in our recent history called Last Days in Vietnam. Check your local listings and otherwise visit pbs.org. It's 8:41. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with one of the country's most talented and successful writers, Steve Barry. You may know that name from a number of best-selling novels that he has written, I think 9 or 10 by now, around the figure of Cotton Malone, and several other novels as well. He's extremely successful. And this latest novel, yet another in the Cotton Malone series, is called The Patriot Threat. And like most of Steve Barry's works, it is rooted in American history. In this particular case, rooted in a reality that involves the laws that brought into being our income tax and the possibility that if indeed that legislation was somehow fatally flawed, and in fact there is no reason for us to have income tax, think of what a secret, what a powerful secret that could be in the hands of someone who, in a sense, wanted to disable the United States in a fiduciary fashion. That's just one ingredient in this really thrilling novel by Steve Barry, which, by the way, is in a sense kind of a book within a book. And we'll explain that in just a moment. The book is published by Minotaur Books. Again, it's called The Patriot Threat. And Steve Barry, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Talk for a moment about this genre in which you are working, that this is not just a novel, but a novel that is, and not just a thriller, but a thriller that is based in history with some intriguing historical facts that are woven into the mix. Talk a moment about this interesting niche in which you like to write.
Yeah, I like to take something from the past, something forgotten, something you may not know anything about, and get you to learn more about it. And that's the hook that I go through. That's the hook as I put it together. And in this case, it was something that happened 100 years ago with the ratification of the 16th Amendment, something that's real, that really did happen. The Solicitor General at the time warned the Secretary of State that there was problems in the ratification process. He told the Secretary of State to move with caution here, but the Secretary of State ignored that advice and declared the 16th Amendment in effect. He didn't declare it ratified, which is very interesting. He said in effect. And the amendment took over. About 20 years ago, someone went behind that to find out what the Solicitor General was actually upset about and discovered something quite shocking. In nearly all 42 states that considered the amendment, there were problems. In 15 of the states, there were problems so severe that they most likely did not even ratify the amendment. You only have to void 6 states to void the amendment. And so it's just this fascinating thing that happened so long ago that could have catastrophic consequences today. So I wove this thriller using this as a weapon against us.
Let's talk for a moment about the title character, not the title character, but the central character in the novel, for the sake of any of our listeners who are not familiar with who Cotton Malone is.
Yeah, he's a retired Justice Department agent. He lives in Copenhagen. He runs an old bookshop and kind of stays in trouble all the time. He's had 10 adventures now. I don't write them, though, where you have to read them in order or anything. You can read them in any order you want, and I write them almost like standalones in some respects. And so he's been around a little while, and now he gets caught up in this constitutional crisis. And it's for the first time I was able to do the whole thriller in 23 hours. So everything happens in this book really fast. And the reader is going to find out some cool stuff about Franklin Roosevelt and Andrew Mellon and the $1 bill and a painting that hangs in the National Gallery of Art. It's there in Gallery 62. A man named Hyman Solomon, who helped finance the American Revolution. All of this is going to be woven around this constitutional crisis that Cotton gets caught up in.
And, of course, because it's a thriller, just about everything that happens is cloaked in a deep veil of secrecy. One of the dynamics that is especially interesting in the book, and I should think to at least some extent very true to life, is the fact that we have, in a sense, different government agencies not fully cooperating with each other. In many cases, not cooperating at all.
No,
being very possessive of the secrets which each of them sort of hold in their pocket. And for understandable reasons to a point, but we're also sort of painted this very vivid picture of how that can really undermine their own respective efforts.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you're trying to keep your own little secrets in your own little niche, but unfortunately they're spilling over, and that's part of the novel illustrates that of how this happens. Treasury Department has a secret in which they don't want anyone else to know, and unfortunately, you know, it gets out, and once it gets out, then it becomes just a disaster across the board, and you know, everyone's trying to plug this leak as this leak gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and you know, That's part of what I wanted to illustrate somewhat, was the how the left hand and the right hand sometimes in the intelligence business has no idea what they're doing. And in this case, it could have catastrophic consequences because of what's happening out there. I have a rogue North Korean. I was fascinated with North Korea. This is an interesting country I know almost nothing about. And I wanted to learn more about it. I wanted the reader to know more about it. But, you know, really, North Korea can't hurt us. It's more a nuisance than anything else. It's not really anything that causes us any serious harm unless they could get a hold of something that they could use our own laws against us. They could turn our own rules against us. And that's what this rogue North Korean is after. He's after his birthright, and he's going to take America down. And I modeled him after a real guy. The actual leader of North Korea right now was not supposed to be the leader of North Korea. His older brother was supposed to have that job. But his older brother tried to take one of his children and sneak into Japan to go to Disneyland. He got caught, and he embarrassed his father, and his father stripped him of his birthright. And that's why we have the leader we have now. And that older brother still lives in Macau and is still alive, so I loosely based my antagonist on what happened to him.
Mm. And, of course, one of the things that makes him a dangerous figure is because he is widely viewed as shallow and directionless and so on. And in fact, he is a very, very smart man and a very dangerous man because everybody around him so seriously underestimates
him. That's the whole point. And he likes that. He likes to be underestimated. And he works under the radar. And now he's at the point where he's about to pull this off. Unfortunately for him, Cotton Malone gets in the middle of it, and that's where the thriller aspect of all this comes in. But there's just there's a lot of real things in the book. I try to keep my books about 90% to reality. I only trip it up about 10% of the time for the entertainment value. And I have a writer's note in the back, though, that tells you where I trip you up.
Mm. In other words, it really spells out the whole matter of fact versus fiction.
Yes, and I want you to know that. I don't want you to leave the book thinking something is real and it's not. It's usually the other way around. You're going to think something's false, and you're going to discover that it's real because, as I said, I keep the book about 90% close to reality.
Hmm. We're speaking with Steve Barry about his latest novel, which is called The Patriot Threat. It's one of a number of books which he has written, thrillers involving a figure called Cotton Malone, once an elite intelligence division officer within the Justice Department, and now on his own in semi-retirement, but pulled out of semi-retirement again and again. In fact, talk about the small elite group which he now is affiliated with.
Yeah, I created the Magellan Billet. It was just something I made up one day because I thought, well, why don't the Justice Department have something that can work for the Attorney General and do what needs to be done in a covert way? So I created this concept of the Magellan Billet. Cotton retired out a few years ago, and he moved to Copenhagen, and he runs that old bookshop. But he just can't help it. He just gets keep drawing back in. And I transitioned Cotton a little bit for a while. He was drawn back in because of things happening to his friends and family, those kind of things, these personal reasons to bring him back in. But, you know, after a while, you kind of run out of those. So he's kind of transitioned now into an agent for hire, and he kind of gets hired back in and for what he thinks is one thing, which quickly becomes something else, and that's what happens here. A simple little meet-and-greet recon mission turns into this big 23-hour adventure that he has to, you know, go across Venice and Croatia to deal with, while my other character, Stephanie Nell, who heads the Magellan Billet, is in Washington, D.C., dealing with that aspect of it. And all of this is happening simultaneously as this constitutional crisis begins to unravel.
Talk for a moment about constructing a thriller that plays out on several stages simultaneously, and stages that are all over the world. I'm really impressed at the clarity with which this novel unfolds, for as complicated as the story in fact is, and how tightly packed that story is.
Thank you. I work hard on that, because you've got to make sure that what's happening in one side of the world has relevance to what's happening on the other side of the world. And it only has relevance in the reader's mind, because the reader is actually privileged to both worlds. And so they're parallel, but they are somewhat intertwined with one another and interconnected, and that's what makes them work, is that interconnection. And I keep that connection going until eventually these two worlds hit up to each other and butt up to each other. Now, in this case, they only butt up to each other from the standpoint of the plot. They still stay separated and from one side of the globe to the other. But I have to be careful to keep them as close to one another as I can in the reader's mind. Otherwise, you'll get confused. And, you know, this time I thought I kept them pretty tight.
Hmm. So you, as you have already talked about, are utilizing a couple of people from our own history who really lived.
Yeah.
And one of them was this man by the name of Chaim Salomon.
Chaim Salomon, yeah.
You call him in the writer's note one of the unsung heroes of the American Revolution.
No question.
Tell us why we should know his name and how you utilize his legacy in this novel.
Well, we should know him very much so, because he's the man who financed the American Revolution. You can't run a war without money. And he's the guy that found the money to keep the revolution going. And he also loaned the country $800,000 of his own money that kept the country going. And Washington was so appreciative of what Chaim Salomon did that he asked him, what would you like as a thank you? Salomon says, I don't want anything for me, but I'd like something for my community. And he was Jewish. So Washington said, okay, fine, this is what I'll do. On the Great Seal of the United States, above the eagle, on the back of the $1 bill, you can see the Great Seal. Above the eagle are 13 stars. And those stars supposedly were arranged to form a perfect Star of David in appreciation to Chaim Salomon. Salomon died in 1785. He never actually saw the country formed. Five times Congress has considered repayment of the money we owe Salomon. Five times Congress has said no. That debt today would be worth somewhere around $300 billion, and we've never paid him back. So to me, Salomon is as much a founding father as any of the others that we recognize.
Right. And, of course, one of the contentions of your novel is that if there were somehow proof, evidently proof that, in fact, ultimately disappeared, that such a debt, in fact, was owed,
yeah.
If proof of that could be somehow recovered or rediscovered, it would put the United States in a very uncomfortable position.
Very much so, an embarrassing position, too. What happened was the documentation for the notes that were owed to Salomon were turned over to the Pennsylvania treasurer in right after his death in 1785, and that documentation just vanished. It just disappeared. And that's how Congress has refused to pay the debts back, because they say we don't have any proof that we owe him any money. Even though history says we do, they don't have any documentary proof of it.
Hmm. How about the figure of Andrew Mellon? I suspect a real student of American history might know who Mr. Mellon was, but many Americans would probably have no notion or only the vaguest notion.
Richest, most powerful man in America in the 1920s. Served as Secretary of Treasury for 11 years across three different presidents, which, by the way, is a tough thing to do. I hypothesized in the novel how he managed to pull that off. Franklin Roosevelt hated him, and Mellon hated Roosevelt. They had a blood feud between them. Roosevelt hated him so bad that he had him indicted for tax evasion. Mellon beat the charge, but these two men just went at it, and finally they met face-to-face on December 31st, 1936 in the White House, and that is the prologue of the novel, when these two people finally come together, and that's where the National Gallery of Art was born. I just added another element to their feud to make it even deeper and more intense, and that forms the basis of the Patriot Threat. But it was fascinating to study Mellon because he was such a powerful man behind the scenes, and he was so wealthy. And he's one of those guys we don't know a whole lot about, but we need to.
Hmm. We've already touched on what, in many respects, is kind of the central matter here, the controversy which surrounds the creation and the ratification of the 16th Amendment to the Constitution, which, of course, is why all of us pay income taxes. And a question has been drawn up about that process by which that ratification took place. When you kind of outline some of this in the writer's note, you say that whether these charges or concerns are in fact fully true, you leave that to the reader to determine. I think what you're saying there is you're not insisting that they're absolutely truthful, but if they're true, they make for fascinating grist for a novel.
There you go. Yeah, this is not a manifesto for not paying your taxes. We all got to pay our taxes. And it's a novel, which by definition is not real. What it is, though, is bringing to your attention something that happened 100 years ago, something that is true, that really did happen, something that has some fascinating implications and some just interesting aspects to it. And hopefully the reader will want to learn a little bit more about that and take a look at some of that. I've done several books now with the Constitution and some of these constitutional quirks. I'm fascinated by the flaws and quirks in our Constitution. And I've explored two or three of those, and I've still got a couple of more to go. And this is one that just I came across and I just couldn't resist. It just, as I said, made for a really good thriller.
Right. And, of course, I think for a lot of us living in modern America, we are intrigued by the notion that documents from over a century ago or a transaction which occurred more than 200 years ago could have such direct relevance to us today.
That's right. That's all of my books deal with that. Something from the past that's still relevant today. That's the what I call the so what. You know, who cares if the 16th Amendment wasn't ratified properly? Well, okay, I'll show you why we care in a so what. Someone could use that as a weapon against us. Since, as I said, the government derives 90% of its revenues from income tax, what if they were able to avoid that and turn our own laws against us? It's like, as one of the characters in the book says, it's the cleverest weapon of mass destruction ever.
The book, again, is called The Patriot Threat, and it's published by Minotaur Books. It's the latest Cotton Malone novel by Steve Barry. Steve Barry, a great pleasure for me to speak with you on The Morning Show about your very exciting newest book. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, sir.
Monday on The Morning Show, I'm excited to reconnect with operatic soprano Angela S. Brown. She is coming to Southeast Wisconsin next weekend for performances both in Racine and Kenosha of her presentation called Opera from a Sista's Point of View, in which she gives wonderful, humorous, heartfelt introductions to some of the arias which are a part of her repertoire. She's a terrific singer, a terrific personality.